Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello and welcome to the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest today is Alan Savory. Alan Savory co-founded the Savory Institute, which today includes an international network of more than 50 hubs that create localized impact through the training and support of holistic management practitioners who work on regenerative land grazing. Alan has worked in this field for many, many years. He pursued his career as a research ecologist and a game ranger in wild areas of Africa that were set aside as natural parks. And after observing an enormous amount of loss of biodiversity in these areas, he figured out what the problem was. Trying to change that has been his life's work ever since then. It led him to a significant breakthrough in understanding the causes of biodiversity loss and the desertification that it led to and how to reverse it. As an independent scientist, he worked across disciplines on all facets of the problems desertification leads to: poor people, social breakdown, and political upheaval. His focus now is on changing the way resource management policies are developed using the holistic management framework he created in the 1980s with input from over 1,000 fellow scientists so that policies successfully address the underlying cause of the problem they are meant to address. It's a huge honor to be talking to Professor Savory. He is somebody who's been speaking unpopular truths for a very long time and explaining to the world ideas that people don't want to listen to. So I'm sure he's going to sound very familiar to Bitcoiners, as we're quite used to this kind of a reception to our ideas. I believe there's something about Professor Savory's ideas that is similar to the Austrian school ideas in economics, in that they are very much outside the mainstream. They are rejected by the mainstream, and yet
the rejection consists of what I would call highly unpersuasive and unconclusive accusations. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Savory.
Thank you. Can I correct one thing first? I'm not professor, and I don't have a
that's right.
PhD. I was going to go to Berkeley to do a PhD, but war intervened, thank God. And that's saved me, because literally we never would have broken through if I'd gone down a narrow path of speciality. So I remained an independent scientist and literally had to cross all disciplines to eventually working with many other people in their private capacities, not their institutional capacities. We were able in 1984 approximately to what I call break through and understand more deeply what was going on, why there's such chaos all over. You're seeing just mounting chaos in the world. So I'll use the word we frequently, because nothing I'm talking about could have been discovered by one person or in one country, and it never could have emerged from any institute, any university, government. We were finally able to put together, had to come from a particular time in history, particular small country with small population. We can go into these if need be, to be able to come up with such new thinking. But you're right. It's been strongly opposed for most of my work for over 50 years. In fact, 60 years now.
Yeah, my general feeling of credentials is that they are a counter signal at this point. So when I hear that somebody has a PhD in something on a topic, I generally discount their opinion rather than weigh their opinion more heavily, because it usually means wrong. It usually means crowdthink. It usually means this is a person who knows how to believe what they're told, primarily these days.
Well, I don't go quite so far. I draw a distinction. People say I'm anti-research, anti-reductionism, etc. I'm not at all. I would not be alive if it wasn't for people with PhDs, reductionist research, etc. I've been shot twice. I've had many African diseases, cancer. I go for a major operation on my eye tomorrow. None of this could have happened without speciality, and we couldn't have discovered what we did finally without speciality. Where I draw the line is in these narrow fields of specialization when it comes to management. You see, it's management you're dealing with in economics. It's management I'm dealing with in institutions, economics, and nature, or our life-supporting environment. Here we're dealing with complexity. So that's where a narrow training, as John Ross and Saul wrote about in his book, becomes a real problem.
Okay. All right. Yeah, point taken. All right, now tell us a little bit more about your story and how you started off in the field of conservation.
Well, I began just with a passion for wildlife. Only went to university to get older, because there was a minimum joining age of 25 years of at the time I left high school, and I just wanted to hunt elephants and study elephants and be in the game department, but I was too young. So I went to university and got a basic degree, very basic, ecology, botany, geology, and joined the game department. So I never had any aspirations to academic study. But when I got into university, I found I had a real passion for ecology. I didn't have to study. I didn't have to do any swatting for exams. I just listened to lecturers, just read the stuff, and that was it. And in fact, started not arguing, but discussing with the very nice professors we had, botany and zoology, and because they were teaching us things like plant ecology and animal ecology. And to my ecological mind, like a young ecological Mozart, as it were, this didn't make any sense at all. I didn't see how you could ever have animal ecology without plants, or how you could ever have plants without animals. And so I would say, well, why can't we just study ecology? And the zoology professor would say, Savory, if you want to be a bloody zoologist, go to the, if you want to be a bloody botanist, go to the botany department. And the botany professor would say the same thing. If you want to be a bloody zoologist, go to the zoology department. And I'd say, but professors, we're a small university and I'm in both. And that doesn't make any sense. And you've probably seen more lately, I mean, even textbooks coming out like fire ecology. Well, that's about as illogical as having chainsaw ecology. You can't have fire ecology. That's a tool, fire. And recently, one of my strongest critics on the international scene, George Monbiot, who writes a lot for The Guardian, he came out with a book, Regenesis, in which I'm probably the most criticized scientist. And he starts the book, it's really all about agriculture producing food through factories and so on and not from farms. And in the beginning of the book, he starts by talking about how management had changed the ecology along the River Wye in England. Well, just that sentence tells you that he's ecologically illiterate, because ecology is a branch of science. How can you change a branch of science along a river? So you can't. And we have got, I'm sad to say, terrible ecological illiteracy in the world.
Yes, I think we're going to get into George Monbiot and his views on these things. It's the I think he's a great poster child for urban environmentalism, in the sense of people who want to get all of their, he wants to get his food from factories, and he thinks he can opine on how nature works, because he doesn't see the connection between how land supports us and how land allows us to live and thrive. And so he thinks he could just get the food from a factory and then we can leave land to thrive on its own without our impact, because he doesn't understand how those two things are connected. So initially, you were working in all these natural reserves, and you came to the realization that what you were doing was harmful. So you tried to get rid of the large mammals in order to preserve the biodiversity, but you realized that this was a mistake. Why was that the case?
You see, it's long been a human belief that if land is being damaged, land, vegetation, etc., and animals are involved, it's too many animals. There are thousands of PhD dissertations and peer-reviewed papers in range science about land degradation, desertification, etc. I don't believe you'll find a single one that defines overgrazing, because humans just knew that overgrazing is too many animals. So I was taught that at university. And when I saw this loss of biodiversity in national parks, it was obvious it was too many elephants. They were destroying the trees, etc. I was working with people like Sir Frank Fraser-Darling, probably one of the world's top ecologists at the time in the 1950s. I was a youngster, 20 years old by then. The Game Department had made an exception, and I joined 25 years under the joining age. And then I was in charge of a big area. So I just did like all scientists do. I gathered the data and interpreted the data in line with our beliefs. And so I proved there were too many elephants. We had a government inquiry into my work. They agreed with me, all the people, the experts that were brought together. And we went ahead, and our government in the subsequent years shot 40,000 elephants. And of all the many, many people involved and scientists involved in that, I was the only one that said, hang on, we're wrong. It got worse. It didn't get better. And it's still getting worse as we talk today. And yet I'm still the only scientist in over 50 years that would admit error. because that's one of the things we learned. Institutions don't admit error, and everybody involved worked for an institution. So anyway, I made the same mistake all scientists are making. This is probably a good time to talk about what one of the things we've discovered is that there are two types of discovery. All right, there are things that are discovered that are new, and the whole world knows it's new. Institutions, organizations know it's new, and citizens know it's new. And that type of discovery can be subjected to experimental protocols and things of that sort. There's controversy for a decade or so, but eventually it's rejected or it's accepted by institutions, etc. Now, periodically, very seldom in the history of the world, you get a different type of discovery. Something is discovered that is entirely new, but institutions that defend the beliefs of society know it is not new. They know it is wrong. So when I discovered, and I'm saying I because at that point it was me, in the 1960s, that it was not possible to reverse desertification without millions more cattle, sheep, goats, camels, when the whole world believed the opposite, you see, that was heresy. That was known to be wrong. So not a single institution has supported that in 60 years. They've ridiculed, opposed, etc. So that's a different type of discovery. And slowly it's spreading around the world, but it takes a century or more.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a century really since Austrian economists, my school of economists, tried to tell the world that there's nothing new about the ideas of cranks like John Maynard Keynes or Irving Fisher. It's the same old idea of inflation that's been tried for thousands of years across human history. There's nothing really unique about it. It's not going to fix anything. It's just the same problem over and over and over again, but dressed up in new clothing. But of course, I think related to money itself is the reason why institutions have such inertia and such resistance to changing their mind. In other words, once the die was cast and governments and universities were set on the course of understanding inflationism as being the solution, that generated a self-perpetuating dynamic, which I discuss in my book, The Fiat Standard, wherein this is what governments believe. This is what universities are supposed to teach. Governments can print money to finance universities to continue to produce more and more research along these lines. And therefore, you've severed the feedback loop from reality. Ideas no longer had to be productive and successful in the real world in order to continue to propagate, because they didn't have to be proving themselves out in the real world, because they weren't funded by the real world. You didn't need to be teaching people useful knowledge that would allow them to navigate the real world better in order for them to then pay you back, or in order for them to tell more students to go to your university, in order for them to buy your publications and keep the process going. None of that matters. Even if your ideas were destructive in the real world, even if they didn't help people generate more profits and more returns and better outcomes and better ecology and fewer economic disasters, it didn't matter, because ultimately you get paid by government. And so government can just print the money, and therefore it can keep these ideas functioning. And for me, this is the root cause of all of the insanity that we see in academia. The reason that there are so many ridiculous things in academia, people like to pick on the social sciences. And of course, yes, social sciences and academia today have gone completely bananas. But a lot of the people that pick on social sciences are completely ignorant as to the disasters that exist in the natural sciences, whether it's in climate or nutrition or in many, many fields. I think there are so many problems that just resist being fixed because there is no incentive to fix them, and the money comes from a bottomless well of inflation. But I'd like to get back to the issue of the main issue of regenerative grazing. So you concluded that it wasn't too many animals that was causing the deforestation. So what was causing the deforestation, and how do you solve it?
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddine.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the fiat standard and the Bitcoin standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
All right, well, let me back off from that. The origin of my work was the animals, etc., and the fact that desertification could not be stopped without millions more animals, mostly domestic stock, because they're the most readily available, etc. Now, that, as I said, was totally new thinking. Now, when I discovered that in the 1950s, 60s, we didn't know how to, because every way livestock had ever been managed by humans, by pastoralists, people whose whole culture was livestock, people with incredible knowledge of their connection to the environment and their livestock, no matter how they ran livestock, it led to degradation of the environment and biodiversity loss. And you see that with all the pastoralists today and the steadily advancing deserts of North Africa, et cetera, Mongolia. When I realized we had no option but to use animals, that was the problem. How do you do so? Now, rather than reinvent the wheel, what I did was to look at other professions to see if anybody had dealt with anything as complicated as this. And I'm using the word complicated, not complex, deliberately. We'll come to that. What I found was that business schools, economics, all of them had never dealt with anything as complicated as this. And what they had, you took too much study to get to even understand it. If they did, it wasn't simple. And unless you can do something simply, you can't get ordinary people adopted worldwide. So then I looked logically at the military, because for a great many years, centuries, the armies in Europe had to fight battles, and they'd started with squares, cavalry on the right, you know, archers behind, whatever, infantry in the square, bashing away at each other, learned that that was senseless. Over the centuries, the armies of Europe had learned that you can't fight battles with any set system or any system, and you have to fight it with a planning process. And then they had learned that how to train people quickly in times of war, how to plan in immediate battlefield conditions. So here we have about 1,000 years of European military experience, and I thought, well, I'll just crib that. So I copied that, and that's why I always credit Sandhurst Military Academy with the way we broke through to handling livestock. So we developed what is a planning process, today called holistic planned grazing. And I'm not exaggerating, anybody can check on me, we have not had a single failure in 50 years because it's got 1,000 years of practical experience behind that planning process. So we thought we were home and dry, and I was getting great results in 5 countries. Then I was forced into exile politically because I was also leading the opposition to the racist government that we had in Rhodesia at the time. and I was forced into exile. And all of my people I was working with, clients, in five countries, pretty well reverted back and land started to slide again. And I realized the problem wasn't them, it was me. When I investigated, I found I'd made them client dependent. And so I stopped consulting and began teaching. Since then, I've never really consulted. I've only tried to teach people so that they know what they're doing and don't become dependent on someone else. Now, when that was going on, the things that I found going wrong were for two reasons that I had neglected, not understood. And one was what brings me to you. It was the economic part of the management that had gone wrong in some. Borrowing at easy money, at low interest, compound interest, etc., leading to bankruptcy. And I had been dealing with the land side of it, but not the economic side of it. And then I found others had gone wrong because something had gone wrong on the social side of it. And it could be as simple as a divorce. There's nothing like a divorce on a farm to break things down. And I hadn't looked at the social side of things. So that's when, as an exile coming to America, I realized we've got to deal with the social side, the cultural side, we've got to deal with the economics, and we've got to deal with the land at the same time, simultaneously. They're indivisible. Now, American universities, some of them had been studying what I was doing. It was known what I was doing. And when I came to America, the government, the USDA, through the Soil Conservation Service, engaged me for 2 years to put 2,000 fellow scientists through training in what I was developing. That's when we really broke through. I was dealing now with people that were violently opposed to what they were learning from me and to people who were extremely enthusiastic and open-minded. So we had both extremes. And you learn from both. And it was then that we had this incredible opportunity of 2 year period of working on the economic, the social, and the environmental side of the problem. And as I say, that's when we broke through and realized we cannot divide them. So let's just leave the land side of it and let's get to what you and I are really working on, which is how the hell do we begin to put this right? I mean, you're working. I loved your stuff. I've got your books here, your Bitcoin Standard, your Faces, the famous one, the Fiat Food. I've been going through them all. They're full of underlinings. I read every sentence two or three times, trying to truly get what you're getting at. And you said just now the root cause of why there's so much institutional stupidity is this fiat money, printing of money, etc. It's a part of the problem, but if that was the cause of it, then we wouldn't have had it happening when we had the gold standard long before, because more than 20 civilizations have failed long ago from the same problem. And under all types of hard money, soft money, etc. So there's something deeper. And then also, when you look at it, we wouldn't be seeing the deterioration we are in national parks. Go to New Mexico or come to Zimbabwe, Botswana, Zambia, you know, where I live today, surrounded by 30 national parks. And they are shocking examples of dying trees, eroding riverbanks, species disappearing, lots of species disappearing, the opposite of what is intended. Now, if you look at those, we can't blame fiat money. We can't blame poaching because it doesn't create habitat destruction. We can't blame hunting, they're national parks. We can't blame livestock, they're not there. I'm just going through the things that institutions blame. We cannot blame corporate greed. We cannot blame corruption. We cannot blame politics. And you can go through everything. We cannot blame colonialism. We cannot blame slavery. And I'm just mentioning all the things that I've heard environmental organizations and other institutions blame. You can go through the whole lot and they're not applicable. And you're left with only one thing that we can attribute that to, professional management. And as I say, so cases like that, that are outliers, they show us that, yes, there's no question. I love what you're doing. And there's absolutely no question. We have to get some way of financing transactions. You can't go back to simple barter. You have to get some that money in the middle that doesn't devalue and get devalued for all the reasons you've said. And I, as I said, I really genuinely loved your writing, the clarity of it, etc. And I loved Fiat Food, but all the first part of it going through the incredible institutional stupidities, fraud, all these things, documenting it so well. But at the end of the day, the problem is deeper than that. So let's try and discuss that, because somehow we need people like yourselves and the Austrian School of Economics and others. And I've just come last week from Colorado. I spent 2 days with some invited people, including John Fullerton of the Capital Institute, who used to be a Wall Street guy, and saw the light. And so I got people together to just discuss the real root cause of the problem and how we can think economically different, because the economic link in this is the weakest. Let me put it this way. At COP26, I gave a very short talk. I was asked to talk about regenerative agriculture, one of three people invited to do so. In that talk, which is a 12-minute talk, you'll see I say I don't intend to, because other people know far more about agriculture than I do, and they're talking here. I intend to talk about the root cause, what I believe is the root cause of the problem. And that, I pointed out, is now all scientists are unwittingly acknowledging is management. Now, why do I say that? I say that because if you look at climate change, all right, which is really just biodiversity loss, desertification, megafires, fueling climate change along with fossil fuels, all right, and now they're feeding on each other. When you look at that, we've had many scientists in denial and a great many citizens in denial. Now, within the last 2 or 3 years, almost every sane person has acknowledged, yes, humans are changing the climate. And so with that acknowledgement that we are causing it, humans are causing it, that is profound. And the media has missed it. My fellow scientists are missing it. Science is logical. And if we are causing climate change, then fossil fuels can't be doing it, and livestock can't be doing it. There's no way you can have two things causing the problem. It is how we manage livestock. It is how we manage fossil fuels that is leading to desertification, biodiversity loss, climate change. So what we need to do is to focus on management. Now, when we focus on management, what do humans manage? Now, here we come to the second of the discoveries that we made in the 1980s that were regarded as wrong by all institutions. Humans, and probably yourself and everybody listening to us, believe that we manage thousands of things every day, millions of things. No, we don't. We discovered in the 1980s that humans only manage three things. Three. We produce millions of things. We produce music, art, literature, money. You know, you could produce all sorts of things. We produce different forms of food, milk, bread, you know, wheat, cheese, meat, whatever. We produce bombs, cell phones. You think of it, we produce millions of things. They are complicated. They stop if you stop producing them. They're not self-organizing. So what then do we manage? And we only manage humans. We manage our families, ourselves, and our organizations, institutions through which we manage at scale. And then humans have to finance themselves. We have to stay solvent. Our corporations, our institutions have to be funded. So we manage the economy. And then we manage our life-supporting environment or nature to produce everything that we do. So we're only managing three things. Now, when you think of everything we produce, we can produce it independent of everything else. So we can produce milk or meat. We can produce grain or sugarcane. We can produce bombs or cell phones. Everything we produce can be produced independently. Now, think of the things we manage, which you and I are so involved in. Can you manage the economics without managing humans first? No, you can't. It's done through institutions. Economics at scale is managed through institutions. I cannot make a pencil like this. Almost nobody can these days, made by a company. Everything at scale is done through an organization. Then we manage the economy, and then we manage nature through which everything is produced. Everything humans produce, use, comes from nature and goes back to nature. And we cannot choose to manage even the family without the economics. The family's got to be funded. I mean, you see even poor people begging for money. And we cannot manage nature until we can pay somebody, use money, use tools, use labor. So here we are with the three things we manage, and they're indivisible. Every day, they're absolutely indivisible. So we discovered that, as I said, in the 1980s, and then worked out how it could be done. So that's what I really would love to talk about. And when we look at this, the human part of what we manage through institutions, we understand fairly well now why institutions are so stupid and incapable of common sense, what you were mentioning a moment ago. We've got the middle piece, the economic piece, and global finance is driving environmental destruction. And then we've got nature. Now, we understand the principles of ecology and how nature functions since life developed on Earth. We understand those principles pretty well now. Now, the economic piece in the middle is the great weakness, as you're finding, and we're trying to solve that middle part. Now, one of the difficulties with the middle part, and please correct me, anyone can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm desperately trying to just say what a lot of us have discovered working independent of our institutions, because all the people that helped me discover this defied their institutions to do so. Now, what's going wrong on the human side, the organization side, is fairly well known by system scientists. And it was a professor at Montana who pointed my nose that way back in the 80s and suggested I have a look at that, which I did. Now, human organizations are defined as complex soft systems. They are complex. They're not complicated. So the moment we form an organization, it takes on a life of its own. No organization is a human being. An organization, a corporation, an institution will be a human being when we hang the first one for murdering. A human is held responsible. An organization is never really held accountable when things go wrong. Right? So they take on a life of their own, and they have what are called wicked problems. Not necessarily amoral, but meaning almost impossible to solve. Now, they're three wicked problems that are the elephant in the room, Nobody talks about them. They're known in research, and I never, ever hear anybody talking about them. We're going to have to start talking about them. Now, one of these wicked problems is that human organizations reflect the beliefs of society in which they formed. And then when new discoveries come along that they know are wrong, they fight those to the death. And it takes anywhere up to 200 years to get acceptance. Galileo, Semmelweis discovering bacteria, you can name it. They have very few cases, but they fought to the death, like I faced, because there are two new heresies involved in solving this problem. When they defend, it's only against new thinking that they know is wrong. If you look at everything that's within human beliefs, they lead the way. So humans believe in technology, go into any organization, latest cell phones, latest computers, latest software, latest of everything. Humans believe in planting trees. So a woman got a Nobel Prize for planting trees for peace in Kenya. Hasn't produced any peace and never will. It can't. All right? It's because institutions award the Nobel Prize and they believe in it. People are planting trillions of trees to try to stop biodiversity loss and desertification. It's failing everywhere. I've been to the UAE and looked at over $30 billion of planting trees and the desert sand just blowing through it. But they just keep on because it's institutions and people believe in it. Now, the second wicked problem they have is you and I and everybody listening to us is capable of humanity and common sense. Most people are good. Most people are decent, and they're capable of common sense and being humane. Now, institutions are almost incapable. They're inhumane in their actions many of the times, you know that, and they're incapable of common sense. You've only got to ask people in the United States, for example, does it make sense for America to produce oil to grow corn that Americans don't eat much of, to produce sugars and syrups from it, and to feed cattle that don't have beaks and don't eat much grain, and to produce ethanol to fuel cars? And any normal person will say that is stupid, that is inhumane, in a hungry world that we have, etc. And yet thousands of people with PhDs working for institutions are doing that. Now, the third of the wicked problems that are we've got to face and deal with, institutions won't readily admit error. I said, talking about the elephant problem earlier, of the probably hundreds, if not thousands, of scientists involved in the culling, and they still want to start it again, all right? Only one independent scientist said, look, we're wrong. This was a screw-up. The others are still defending it and still praised as good scientists because they institutions don't like to admit error. Now, most people grasp that very quickly if we look at religions. I'll just look at one. I'll look at Christianity, but you could look at, I think, any of them. And what the founder had to say was very, very simple, basically love and caring. Now, for 2,000 years, millions and millions of ordinary people have been capable of love and caring. What happened when institutions took over, when we managed religion at scale? If you just take that one religion, there are over 2,000 Christian churches, and they've been killing each other, torturing each other, going to war for centuries. And if you look at the Catholic Church, wonderful people, millions and millions of loving, caring, wonderful people. Look at their organization protecting pedophile priests for centuries, going against everything that every one of the individuals, ordinary citizens, wouldn't do. So, and nobody's being wrong. Nobody's being wicked. Institutions are not humans. So that's where we begin the chain that's got to be managed simultaneously. So institutions have to manage the economy. And you, unless you deal with the problems, the wicked problems in institutions, I doubt we'll ever get the economic part of the link right. And then when we're trying to simultaneously manage nature, as we cannot escape doing, we literally cannot do it at scale until we face the reality of institutions. And we have to have them. They're our most efficient way of doing things, and it's literally not possible at large scale to do it without an organization. But I think I'm probably one of the only people in the world talking like this. And everything I'm telling you is known.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's very, very interesting. Now, I want to go back to your discussion on climate change. The way that I look at it, I'm not sold on the idea that carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere increasing from 280 parts per million to 420 parts per million over the course of two centuries is really something that's causing a crisis for humanity. And so I'm not too fond of the entire framing of the idea that this is a climate crisis, that there is a climate problem. I think the climate changes. It has always changed. It will always change. I think this is just reality. But I don't believe that our emissions from us and from the cows and from the cars that we drive and the airplanes and industry are having that significant impact on the Earth's climate because of CO2. And it's something that I've discussed extensively in this podcast before. We've had Richard Lindzen, William Happer, and several other people here to discuss this. But I'm curious about your idea here that you say that it is climate change is deforestation. And I think that's something that I can get behind. I can see how human beings can cause deforestation, and I can see that that can change the climate.
Can I correct something there?
Yes,
can please. I correct something there? I never said deforestation is the cause of climate change, and it's not.
I think you said that you view climate change as deforestation. It's a form of
I never mentioned deforestation. I said people believe in that, and they believe in planting trees.
I'm sorry, desertification. I should say desertification.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the correct one that you said.
Sorry. Yeah.
Okay. So what is your understanding of climate change, and are CO2 emissions instrumental in it?
Okay. In the TED talk I gave that's gone to about 9 million people, I said I didn't give my views because there's too much murkiness, too much unknown, and I like, as a scientist, I like to be as sure as we can before stating something. So I said people who know far more about carbon than I do state such and such, and I've been much criticized for that. Now, going to your carbon thing, it's what is happening is, and it began, climate change began 50,000 years ago, long before we were burning coal and oil, right? And what is happening is that biodiversity loss, which began thousands of years ago on most continents, about 80% of the genera of large animals were killed by humans. All right, thousands of years ago. So biodiversity loss began, desertification began as humans replaced animals with fire, and whole continents began to change with that. Now, biodiversity loss, desertification, eventually leading to megafires, and that's occurring over roughly two-thirds of the world's land, where the rainfall is very seasonal, and where dead vegetation every year oxidizes in sunlight, which is a chemical breakdown. And humans counter that by burning it to stop it killing grass and creating bare ground, right? But burning is rapid oxidation. So we've got vegetation now breaking down chemically instead of biologically. And that I explained in the TED talk, that no scientist who has ever studied it has yet criticized. But that talk still carries a disclaimer, and TED was so criticized for even allowing me to talk by institutions that that disclaimer stays there. All right, so biodiversity loss, desertification occurring over about two-thirds of the world's land where the rainfall is seasonal and especially low, is fueling climate change along with fossil fuels. Now, those are feeding on each other now. So if we took, let's say, your argument, and let's for a moment assume you and others saying that are absolutely correct. And this I did with Monbiot the other day when I had to debate him at Oxford, and he refused to debate. He just muddied the water and messed things up, as is his character. But if we assume that's correct, and let's assume that the world's soils and oceans and so on could absorb absolutely no carbon, let's assume we stopped carbon emitting from fossil fuels tomorrow, 100%. Let's assume that cattle put out 10 times the methane that they do. And let's also assume that every human became vegan and we never ate any more red meat again for the rest of life. Now, what would you do about climate change?
There's the thought. I'd kill myself.
Yeah, climate change would continue because of desertification. So whether the carbon in the atmosphere from fossil fuels is right or wrong, we should not take risk and put humanity at risk, and we should begin to handle that. And so even if we keep burning fossil fuels for a while, yet until we are more certain about that, we have to stop desertification. Because if you don't just stop desertification, it doesn't matter what you're going to do. The climate is going to change. And I mentioned that in the TED talk. And what I actually said was, take 1 square meter of land. If you make it bare soil, I know because I go barefoot nearly all the time. I very seldom wear shoes. When you stand on it at dawn, it's very, very cold. After midday, you cannot stand on it. It's too damned hot. It's like putting your foot on a stove. Now, if that's taking place on 1 square meter of land when you make it bare, all right, what's happening when you're making billions of hectares bare, largely in the world, on two-thirds of the world? Now, you don't have to make all the land bare. You just have to make it bare between plants. And if you compare that to covered soil, anybody can do this. Just walk on your lawn or walk on the hot bare ground near your lawn, and you'll feel the difference. So desertification alone is changing the microenvironment on every square meter of land. Now, you cannot do that over millions and millions and millions of acres without changing the macroclimate. So anybody denying climate change is literally not understanding the loss of biodiversity, because desertification doesn't even occur without losing biodiversity. It is a symptom of biodiversity loss. So anybody denying climate change to you is just literally displaying ecological ignorance.
Yeah, no, I'm very sympathetic to this idea of climate change. I don't think that our emissions of carbon dioxide are what's driving climate change. So then how do you fix this? Moving more into more applied ideas on the ground, what is it that you as the Savory Institute do? So if I tell you, say I'm in a country that has a lot of desert and the desert keeps expanding or keeps growing, how do you fix it?
Well, we really cannot except at scale. So we're just doing the best we can with individuals and all over the place. And we've got about 50 hubs now in 30 countries, I think it is. And they're doing the best they can to manage their families, their small communities, their local economy, and the environment. And they're getting incredible results in some cases, really spectacular. Water returning, fish returning, even in dry seasons, desertification reversing, getting tremendous traction there. But it's only the best they can, because with the best will in the world, it's maybe a million hectares in the world that we've got that going on in 50 countries. That is a small proportion. So it's being swamped. And they cannot, individuals can't go further than that, and they cannot truly manage holistically until it goes to scale, because while you or I can manage our family, our farm, our ranch, our pastoral community, and manage our economy, we're managing our economy within a global economy where global finance is driving environmental destruction. So we've got a tsunami coming down on us. And so we cannot put this right until we can begin to do what you're trying to do, but combining it simultaneously with the wicked problems of institutions and nature. So all we're doing in the Savory Institute is saying, all right, I'll concentrate on that. I don't run the organization anymore. Daniela Howell does. She's our CEO, an Argentinian lady who lives in America, has become an American. And she and her whole team are doing an incredible job. But some years ago, we took the decision. We cannot get the world to see this yet because of institutional resistance and bitter opposition from institutions that keep crushing the thinking, distorting the thinking, distorting the information. So we cannot do that. So what can we do in the meantime? Well, what we can do in the meantime is to focus on the grasslands of the world, the savannas and grasslands, which is about two-thirds of the world, as I said, seasonal rainfall. And let's get hubs going there, people in every country we can, managing there, because when the first government in the world actually takes climate change seriously and starts to address it, which is not a single government in the world is doing at the moment, when they do, the place where humans will get the highest return for effort will be in the savannas of the world. That's where we'll get the highest return of stopping soil erosion, droughts, floods, emigration to Europe, changing the political face of Europe, etc., all of which has got nothing to do with fossil fuels or carbon in the atmosphere. It's to do with desertification. So that's why, as a strategy, we're doing that until we can get a government somewhere in the world to take climate change seriously and do what I suggested 2 years ago at COP26.
On a practical sense, what is it that you do? I want to get into the fields. Can we put aside the institutional discussion and the political stuff and the COP conferences and all of that stuff and get down to the fields? What do you guys do? Tell me about how you put in ruminant animals. That's what I want to get to. Because we are very big fans of meat in this show. So I want you to tell us why meat eating is the solution.
I'm not saying meat eating is a solution. I'm just saying you cannot solve the problem without livestock, even if you let vultures eat them. Even if every human becomes a vegan, you're still going to need millions of animals. Now, the basic reason for that I explained in the TED talk, and it is this. Let's take especially low rainfall areas, under 500 millimeters, say, and very seasonal. Not England or Europe or France or east or west coasts of America, etc. You can take the whole of the UK, all right, the whole of it, and wipe it off the map. And it won't make any difference to climate change because the whole of the UK is only the size of an island off the coast of Africa, Madagascar. And Madagascar is desertifying badly. So that's the big problem. Now, why does that occur? Basically, it's this, that the bulk of the cover of the land is from grass plants, not from trees and shrubs, particularly as the rainfall gets lower. You don't have enough rain to give a solid canopy of trees and leaf fall to give you 100% cover of the soil. If the soil is exposed, it starts to die. Soil is a living organism. is not inert. It's a living organism. It needs a skin. And its skin is litter and plant cover. And the more of its skin that dies, the quicker the soil dies, just like a human. The more of your skin is burnt, the less chance of saving you. All right, so think of soil like a living organism. Now, that soil cover in the greater part of the world's land comes from grass, not trees or shrubs or weeds. Now, a tree or a shrub or a weed grows, and then when the rain stops, and you now have 6 months, 8 months of no rain and dry, the leaves die. And the tree cuts off its own leaf. We call it fall. And the leaves fall on the ground. And then the following year, the tree can sprout from buds because the sunlight can reach the buds. All right, so that's how a tree grows, with the growth points up at the tip. The growth points are not at the ground. Now think of a grass growing up, and it grows up just like a tree does, capturing sunlight. Now, it grows for 4 or 5 months of rain, and it can grow 4, 3 foot, 5 foot, 6 foot high, as it does with us in part of Africa that I'm at. And now we're going to 8 months of dry. Now what happens? You've got 8 months of no rain and dry atmosphere, and all that leaf and stem of the grass dies. But no grass in the world can raise itself. It just stands there. And when it stands there in sunlight, it starts to break down chemically by turning from a yellow sort of khaki color to a gray and eventually black color as it oxidizes. If you look at the outside of a thatch roof, it's black. If you look at the inside of a thatch roof, it's yellow. The outside is in sunlight and oxidizing. So as that oxidation takes place, it can take 10, 5, 15, 20 years to break down, just like a thatch roof does. It takes years to break down. Now, with that's happening, and the growth points of the grass are not up at the top, they're down at the ground level, out of harm's way from grazing animals, because they co-evolved with grazing animals. Now you have the plant standing with this oxidizing material, and sunlight cannot reach the growth points, so the plant dies, and you're left with bare ground. Now, that didn't happen prior to humans on anything like today's scale, because there were millions and millions and millions of herbivores. The plants, the soil, and the large herbivores and their pack hunting predators all co-evolved together. Does that explain it?
Yes, it absolutely does. And I think it makes a lot of sense because, I mean, just if you get on an airplane, you fly over areas like Switzerland, for instance, and you see a lot of grazing animals and rolling hills and grass, and it's all green. Whereas if you fly over areas like the US Midwest, you see a lot of monocrop agriculture all over, and you see that the soil is practically empty. There's nothing there. It's clearly not biodiverse. There isn't any kind of biological diversity there. It's just endless fields of corn or soy or wheat or a few other cash crops. But when you have these animals grazing, everything looks better. I mean, it's you don't see many postcards of corn fields. You see a lot more postcards of rolling beautiful hills because it just is more appealing to the human mind. And I think it's what's really ironic about it is that everybody's constantly saying that the problems of climate come from us eating animals. But in fact, grazing animals is helping the environment. And if we are able to fix our diet, fix our food, we'd be able to eat more animals, more meat, which I believe would be better for us. And it would also be better for Earth because it would keep the nutrients on Earth because it would keep the soil rich, as you were eloquently describing. Would you agree?
Yeah, let me comment. You raised two things there. You said flying over Switzerland and so on, green, and you see a lot of animals grazing. Now, bear in mind, pastoralists every way, ranches, every way livestock are run, rotational grazing, mob grazing, all these things that are talked about leads to desertification. So when you're flying over animals, then you're seeing them scattered on the ground, biodiversity loss is probably occurring. All right, it's not good. The way livestock is run is wrong over almost all the world. That's what we discovered in 1960s and how to correct it. All right, but so let me leave that for the moment. Having animals on the land is not the answer. It's how you manage the animals. And we can come back to talking about that if you like. Now, the other thing you said is, what about the feed? Yes, it's better to eat meat and so on. Now, people will dispute that and argue that. So let's get beyond the argument. The people who are anti-red meat, basically, vegans and so on, a lot of their argument is the cruelty, the inhumanity, etc. Now, humanity is a human concept. Nature is not humane. Nature is anything but humane. So if you and I are vegans for spiritual or whatever reason, that's okay. If we are vegans for ethical reasons or humane reasons, we're doing damage to the world. Now, why do I say that? Because the vegans fight what I'm saying more than most people do, and their argument against, you know, inhumane treatment of animals, I agree with. We should treat animals humanely, like most farmers and ranchers and pastoralists do. They love their animals, right? So what happens if you don't kill and eat animals? You leave them to die in nature. And most of our population today are urban people. They haven't grown up on farms and land, and they don't realize how nature does things. So if you leave anything to die in nature, it doesn't generally die peacefully in its sleep. How do things die in nature? I know because I've watched thousands of animals die because of environmentalists preventing us from managing, and they die from starvation. And it's cruel. It's terrible to watch. And I once watched 50,000 animals, roughly, dying that way. Blocked from doing anything by environmentalists. Now, if they don't die of starvation, in their weakened condition, they stick in the mud, they break a leg, whatever, and they die from accident. It's cruel. It's terrible to watch. Now, if they don't die like that, in their weakened condition or whatever, they die from disease, parasitism and disease. And again, it's cruel. It's a terrible death. And if they're lucky, the animals that are lucky die in the gentle jaws of a lion or a crocodile by predation. Predation is the kindest death in nature. And yet people
why? Say, why would you say that?
Well, because there's no other way of dying. So if you had to take your pick, if I had to take my pick between a croc catching me or a lion catching me or dying of accident because I can't walk, my legs are broken or whatever, and I'm just lying on the ground waiting for a hyena to eat me, or I'm so ridden with parasites and disease that I'm lying under a tree and I can't drink, I can't do anything, and I'm just dying, or I die of starvation, which would you pick?
I mean, I guess the predator is over very quickly.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, people saying, don't kill an animal. Well, if you don't kill an animal, you're being bloody cruel because you're leaving it to nature. So humans, and they've done this for a long time, they love their animals. And they care for them. Their farmers don't put them in damn feedlots and pens and in inhumane conditions and keep them cruelly, as they do in pig pens and chicken pens and all these feedlots that corporations are running. It's a terrible life for the animals. And then, thank God, at least they're killed. And that's reasonably humane. If you look at what farmers and pastoralists do, they love their animals. They care for their animals. Their kids grow up with their animals. And lovingly, at the end of it, they see that they're killed as humanely as possible. And that our city people just don't seem to understand, the cruelty, the damage they're doing. When we need millions more animals on the land to stop biodiversity loss and desertification.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, ultimately, when you were saying that predators' death is the least gruesome of all the deaths, I think, obviously, if we massacre animals, if we slaughter animals, then that's even more merciful because they're finished in a few seconds, basically. They either get a shot to the head, in which case they're dead in less than a second, or they slit their throat, in which they bleed and lose their consciousness in under a minute, I think, or something like that. And both of these are very merciful ways of dying. And I think, realistically, farmers give life to that animal and they take care of it for all of its life. They prevent it from all of these horrible fates that could face it out in nature. As you were saying, nature is not humane. Humans are humane. And instead of getting eaten by predators, instead of getting stuck in the mud and dying with a broken leg, instead of getting sick and dying, farmers take care of their animals and they give them life. They breed them. They bring them into life. And all of that is so that at the end of that life, you suffer for only a few seconds or less than a second, less than a minute maybe, and then that's it. And then, one cow can feed one human being for a whole year, roughly.
Yeah. You know, a moment ago you said humans can be humane and are humane, but remember that farmers as humans are humane. Pastoralists as humans are humane. Now, corporations running feedlots and chickens by the millions and so on are institutions, and institutions are not humane. So you need to draw that distinction, that humans are humane, institutions are. Farmers are humane and produce food humanely. Institutions tend to produce food inhumanely. The animals live a miserable life, a terrible life.
Absolutely. Okay, so what are the correct ways of managing livestock, and how do you, what is it that you do differently from most farmers?
If we're just looking at the livestock part of it now to reverse desertification, and this will give more productivity even in England and humid environments, France, etc., as the French scientist Voisin, André Voisin, wrote 70 years ago. All right, so what is needed when animals, grazing animals are run on the land is no grazing system or rotation because it's too complicated and you've got to plan economically, socially, and for the animals. All right, so it's complex. Now, so this then means that what we do, and I'm going to take the human and the economic side out of it for a moment to try and make it simpler to understand just the livestock. When we have the livestock on the land, what Voisin discovered, so I credit him, was that you need some sort of planning process. Now, if you think about a business, no business runs on a system. It runs through planning process. No army runs on a system, runs through planning process. So grazing animals on the land must not have any prescribed system, flexible as it may be, or anything else. And that's how all humans run them. It leads to the problem. So what we need is a planning process. So that's what I adopted from military thinking. And if you, for instance, are going to put animals on the land, we just teach you a very simple process of laying out what units of land you have, with or without fencing, with herding, whatever. You've got to just divide the land into virtual units or fenced units, 5, 6, 10, whatever, a number of them. And now you need to plan where those animals are going to be on that over the next 6 months or more, of varying rains, season, growth rates, etc. And so it's just a very simple planning process that literally I've trained African school leavers to do in under 2 hours. And so you have a piece of paper on which you've laid out the farm paddocks or the areas, paddocks or units of land, and you go through them bit by bit, just break the whole problem up into little segments because the human mind can't do it all together. And so you break it into little segments and the human mind focuses on one, then forgets it, focuses on the next, forgets it, focuses on the next, and the end of it, you plot where you're going to put the animals. So the steps will be, what months are you planning? Anybody can think of that. Oh, I'm planning the next 4 months or 6 months. Or I put it across the top of the chart, January, February, March, April. That easy. Now forget it. How many units of land have you got? Oh, I've only got 10 separate units of land. Put it down the left of the chart. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Forget it now. Okay? Now, when are your animals going to be breeding, bulling, calving? Oh, such and such a month. Okay, put a red line down the chart because it doesn't matter where they are on the land, you're going to have the bulls with the cows or you're going to have the rams or whatever. You just need to, now you can forget about that. Now you'll go through other things. Have you got any poisonous plants? Yes. Okay, what months are they poisonous? And which areas of the land are they poisonous in? Oh, they're poisonous in this area, number 9 and 10. What months? Okay, put a line through that. You're not going to put animals in there during that time. And you just go through step by step like this. It's like playing a game. It's literally just fun. And then at the end of it, it's like a minefield. You've got these markings, which are breeding seasons, problem plants, erosion, crops coming in on the land, periods where the animals are needed on the crops, periods where they're not, and you just know where do you put the animals. Now, when you're a normal farmer ranching, even if you do some sort of rudimentary planning, you always go forward. From here, they'll go to there. From there, they'll go to there. And so you plan forward. But when you've got a very complex situation, you're actually better planning backwards. Now, you can't rotate animals backwards. You can't do a grazing system backwards. You can use a planning process and plot their moves backwards. So now you can just look at this and say, well, when is the most delicate time for my animals? Well, at this time, the mothers are lactating heavily, whatever. We're expecting them to breed again. We don't want them to fall in condition or whatever. Let's book the grazing. Let's book where they're going to be. Now, how did we get them there? Oh, we brought them from here. Well, how did we get them there? We brought them from here. And you plot backwards. It's a terribly simple process. I promise you I could teach you to do it in 2 hours, even if you'd never farmed before.
That's amazing. And so you think this is something that applies in what kind of regions, or is it just universal? You pretty much do it anywhere.
Do it anywhere, like you can fight a battle anywhere. When the army developed it, they made it universal. That's why I and the Rhodesian army could learn this, although it had been taught in Sandhurst in Britain. And the planned grazing that we use, we've used it on, I think, 4 or 5 continents for 50 years, and I've never known anybody fail. Never once. I've known thousands of people fail to do it and then say, it doesn't work.
Yeah. I mean, people prefer to dismiss things than try them. Trying is a lot harder than pontificating, I guess. That might explain it.
Well, there are also our egos. People have to pretend they came up with something, and they have to give it a twist of their own. So once I started training 10,000 people in the United States, prior to that, there were 3 grazing systems, basically, in the United States. Within 6 months of me starting to train 10,000 ranchers, academics, etc., I think we counted 13 new grazing systems, derivations of my work, where people like taking your joke and telling it as my joke, but I forgot the punchline. They all dropped the planning process. So we got mob grazing, adaptive management grazing, high intensity, low grazing, cell grazing, endless. I think we counted 13 at one point. Different grazing systems in America, all derived from my work. All will fail in the long run. None of them will reverse desertification. That's just human egos, and we can't stop that.
And what's the key missing ingredient, in your opinion?
I think the key ingredient is getting management at scale, because you'll never stop individuals doing what they want to do, adapting, etc. And that's terribly creative. I mean, once the Wright brothers learned how to fly, within 70 years, we were on the moon, because people could release that creativity. So we want to release that creativity, right? But in the Wright brothers' case, everybody who took that idea and didn't follow the principles of flight crashed and didn't mislead anybody. So if we can adhere to the principles of the planning process, something like that, then we can use this human creativity to move even faster for the good of humanity. Now, how do you do that? We have to do it at scale. So that's where we come back to what I'm spending the rest of my life doing. I'm 88 now. I'm still reasonably active. I'm not as physically fit as I used to be, but with the best will in the world, I've only got 3 or 4 or 5 more years. So how can I do the most good for mankind in that time? And I'm concentrating on trying to get somewhere, someone to let us just develop policy in some sovereign state, one state in the United States or a small country or anything, as I suggested at COP26. And let us just take the political leader and let them take no risk, just do what they've always done, because no politician will take risk. Let them do that. But to act as a statesman and let us work, us being the Savory Institute, we'll provide the facilitation skill, nothing more. And let us work with a group of citizens in that country and all their institutions and experts and develop policy holistically. Now, we've done that in training exercises many times, so we know what the outcome will be, and it's what every human is dreaming of, because almost everybody is wanting a better life, freedom to follow their own religious, spiritual values, more nutritious food, clean water. Everybody's wanting the same thing, except for a few insane people. Why is it, when everybody's wanting the same thing, that we're going to war and killing each other? It's because of institutions. So if we take that into account and develop policy together, we come out with a completely different result. So why not let's just do that concurrently in some state, some country, and let everybody observe and see what comes out of it. Now, when we do that, and that's why I was so eager to be on your podcast and discuss with you, the weakest part of it is going to be that middle part, because we know now how to even out the wicked problems of institutions and get them to behave more like a human by getting the cooperation and the will to do so by the people in the organization. So we're beginning to know how to handle that. The principles of nature and how nature functions are pretty solid, pretty well known now, and those never change. It's the economic part that we've got the weak link. Now, the nature part of it, let me say a word on that for a moment. When Al Gore gave his TED talk and showed that hockey stick of carbon in the atmosphere that you were concerned about, he showed it shooting up like this. Yes, but that curve began long, long before with desertification, releasing carbon from eroding, dying soil. When I came to America, America's biggest export, according to the Soil Conservation Service, was dead, eroding soil. It was equivalent of a train load of rail cars filled with soil 119 miles long, leaving the country every day. That's when I came here 40-odd years ago. All right, so that, how to put that right, we now have the basics, the creative farmers, the best, many of the academics know, etc. All right, so when Al Gore showed that curve shooting up like that, I couldn't help to think to myself, now, what else does that coincide with? You know what it coincides with? Nobel Prizes.
Yes.
Nobel Prizes began 102 years ago. They also match that curve. Because once we had Nobel Prizes, that curve shot up. Now, why could that be? Why might that be? I think it's because when the best minds at the time said, what is important for humans to give this very prestigious award to every year, they chose physics, chemistry, argued about mathematics, etc. Now, they finally decided the five or six things that Nobel Prizes are for. Now, that, for over 100 years, has drawn our best young minds into those fields, the hard sciences as they are, basically. And because it's a tremendous draw to get this big award. People want recognition. They want awards. It's prestigious. So it's drawn minds there. And it's only mediocre minds like mine that went into ecology because I loved wildlife. But I have a mediocre mind. I'm not a bright person. I'm just a simple guy. All right, so if we look at that, what happened? Why wasn't ecology the first Nobel Prize? Because without agriculture, you cannot have a choir, a church, a university, an economist. You can't have anything without agriculture and food. And that's the photosynthetic process. Now, without agriculture and the photosynthetic process, you cannot have an economy. You cannot have anything. So the very first Nobel Prize should have been the new branch of science, ecology, on which agriculture is dependent. It wasn't there. And so what do we have today? We have universities teaching things like competition, non-native, invasive. These aren't ecological terms. These are bureaucratic institutional terms. There's nothing in nature that's non-native. There's nothing in nature that's invading. It's synergy. It's functioning with synergy above the population, above the species level. Now, if you look to the level of ecological illiteracy today in our cabinets, in our environmental organizations, our universities, etc., you've hardly got to look further than two of the top scientific bodies in the world. The Royal Society in the UK, very prestigious, wonderful people, or the US National Academy of Sciences. Again, very prestigious, wonderful, highly trained people. Now, about 2 years ago, the two organizations, apparently organized a conference with about 50, invited highly trained specialists to Washington. And the conference, the aim of that was to establish a value of biodiversity, an economic value for biodiversity. Now, that's insane. That's illiteracy, ecological illiteracy. That's like getting the 50 brightest fish in a dying lake together and getting them to discuss the economic value of water. They wouldn't do it. We live in a biosphere, living. A biosphere, a blanket of atmosphere around the Earth. And even the fish in the ocean have gills and have to keep moving to get oxygen. Where's that oxygen coming from? It's coming from life, from biodiversity. Prior to life on this Earth, you had the physical laws. You didn't have the ecological laws because there wasn't any life. Now, when life began to develop, as Smuts wrote about in 1926 in his book, Holism, Evolution, when life began to develop, gradually oxygen in the atmosphere began to develop. So now we have a biosphere, and that is totally dependent for its oxygen, which is vital, as we understand, from biodiversity. So anybody talking about the economic value of biodiversity doesn't understand. You can't put a price on it.
Yeah, I've always found these exercises pretty absurd. I mean, the price is clearly infinity. If we lose this thing, then we stop existing. And so there are no prices left. There's no valuation. And I think these are institutional and bureaucratic excuses for finding reasons to get funding for writing studies that nobody really wants to read or pay for. Because, yeah, we realize this is essential for our existence. So what's the point in putting a price tag on it? I think it's, I completely agree with you. Okay, so what do you see as the realistic possibility in terms of reversing desertification all over the world? Do you really believe that we could increase green and topsoil even in places that are very large deserts? I mean, can Saudi Arabia make its desert bloom?
No, it can't make them bloom in living period if you go into the heart of Saudi Arabia, etc. But remember, North Africa used to be a savanna with hippo and giraffe and everything. And this has taken a few thousand years to create what we've got today. So it's going to take a long time to get back. But we can make a start. Now, on that, we did what we called a trial, charter trial, in Rhodesia in the 1960s. It was the first international trial on what I'm saying about the land part of this. And it came out highly successful, but it was condemned by academics and institutions. Now, at the same time as we did that, I said, look, I want to shoot this thinking ahead and try to prove it wrong. So we took two areas in the country. I'll just talk about the one. We chose the low rainfall and a big ranch, over 1 million acres, Liebig's Ranch, a London-based company. And we got people there to pick the worst land in the whole country. Now, I offered the chairman of the Cattle Producers Association a £5 note, that was roughly $10 at the time, if he could show me a single perennial grass growing in a 100-mile drive. There were none. It was that bad. We had trees, shrubs, leaf fall, bare ground. Now, so we chose the worst land we had there. I got the company to choose the most difficult class of animals to manage, which was first calving heifers, young heifers. And what I did was I said, all right, we're going to take my ideas and we're going to make them fail, but not break the planning process. See if we can just push the animal numbers until it collapses. And on that worst land in the country, we went to twice the animal, the stocking rate, what government and universities said the land could carry. We doubled it immediately. We didn't even wait for the rain. Right? We proved wrong. And so I had to go to three times. That ran for 8 years. We produced five times as much meat per acre. The entire cost, capital outlay, was $1.80 an acre, and it became solid perennial grassland. We did that in the 1960s. The consequence of that was that I got banned from setting foot on any campus of any university in the whole of Southern Africa. Institutions are not human.
That's astonishing. Astonishing that would happen. It really
is incredible. It's not if you understand wicked problems. It's normal for it to happen.
Yeah. Are there any other methods that you think could work for reversing desertification other than holistic management and grazing? Is there anything else? Or do you think this is our best chance?
Well, that's the point I was making to Mombio in that debate, and he wouldn't answer. No scientist in the world has answered me for 60 years. All right, you've got to use tools to reverse desertification. All right, humans are a tool-using animal. If anybody listening to us wants to drink milk, how can they do so without using technology? They can't, unless they go to a cow and suck. You can't even drink water without a glass, technology, a tap, unless you go to the river and drink. So we're a tool-using animal. Now, if you think back on human existence, we had Stone Age tools, and we could not change our environment any more than an otter, a vulture, a crow, a baboon, any tool-using animal. We could not change our environment. So we had the tool of technology, Stone Age tools. Then, somewhere about a million years ago, we got the use of fire, but not the ability to light it. Then later, we got the ability to make fire. Now we had two tools. We had technology and fire, Stone Age tools and fire. Now we could begin at later to melt the stones and go into the bronze, the copper, the iron age. And every bit of technology we have today, the clothing you're in, everything I see in the room around you, everything in the room around me was made possible by fire. There's nothing that I see in the view in front of me, in your room or mine, that could be made before fire. Now, once we got fire, our technology could advance to everything we've got and using today, and we can even put objects into space and explore space with technology. It's still technology made possible by fire. So humans, for all of our existence, had two tools, technology and fire. Now, about 10,000 years ago, roughly, humans developed the idea of resting the environment to let biodiversity recover when they saw the damage. That would have begun with pastoralists moving their livestock or crop farmers rotating their crops. And so we got this tool of rest. Now, today it's being promoted as new as rewilding, coming out of England and now spreading around the world as rewilding, which means rest the environment to let it recover. So you've got three tools, and that's all humans have. We manage three things, and we've got three tools. Now, that simplicity I never saw expressed until I could get it out when I was training with 2,000 people in what the work that I was developing. Now, with those three tools, think about them. Oxidation is what leads to desertification. Resting the environment leads to oxidation. That's why I showed in the TED Talk even research plots in the United States that were turning to desert. So one tool leads to desertification. Now, fire is rapid oxidation, and it burns litter, and it exposes soil. So it leads to desertification. So two of our two tools lead to desertification, not in the humid environments of the world, not in the oceans, all over the humid environments, which is about a third of the world's land, and our water and oceans. Resting the environment is the most powerful thing we can do to restore biodiversity. But on two-thirds of the land, it's not. Right? So now we're left with one tool, technology. No technology, even imaginable in science fiction, can replace chemical oxidation on billions of hectares of grasslands, essentially, in the world every single year with biological decay. So the three tools humans have, it is simply not possible to now save civilization as we know it. Now, when I said we have no option in the TED Talk, I got severely criticized by academics and fellow institutional scientists around the world who said, this is stupid. What scientist says there are no options? I do. And I want one scientist somewhere in the world to tell us what options there are. Future of humanity hangs on that, and it has for 50 years. And all economics hangs on that.
Absolutely. All right. Nathan has a couple of questions. Nathan is saying he wants to recommend a book called Calculated Chaos by Butler Schaefer, all with regards to institutions. You familiar with this book?
I don't know. No, Calculated Chaos. I'm making a note of that. Does that basically also go around why we have such chaos because of wicked problems, or what is it about? We can't discuss with him. Because you see this chaos at every climate conference. Hundreds of very clever people, very knowledgeable people, and just chaos every time. No clarity, just conflicting views on how different ways to produce food, energy, etc., and nobody talking about the problem, which is management.
Yeah. Lawrence is asking, what can normal people do to protect themselves from institutions? I know it is hard, but is there any hope for men and women?
Yeah, there's hope for all of us. I'm very optimistic because we understand the things we're talking about. And I don't want to give the impression that these are my views. These are collected views of a great many people that I've worked with over a long time, who worked independent of their institutions. Now, we have to have our institutions. So ordinary people, we cannot escape it. You're subject to it every day, right, in one way or another. So what we need to do is to begin to rectify it by getting our political leaders to understand that none of them know what to do. There's not a world leader who knows what to do about climate change. That I can promise you. All right? So let's try something that's never been tried before, first time in history, and that's what I outlined at COP26 and touched on earlier. And that just means let's get one leader who's a statesperson to govern as normal in a state or a small country, not take any risk, and just let us work with the citizens and experts and institutions of that country and show them how to address the root cause of the problem, which is not a lack of knowledge, not a lack of good people, not a lack of goodwill. It is the way in which all governments, all environmental organizations develop policy. That is what is causing the problem. Nobody's being wrong. Nobody's being evil. There is no Goliath out there, as I heard one podcaster saying the other day. All these conspiracy theories, I don't believe them. It's this institutional stupidity that's accidental. So let's just have one country try something new without any risk whatsoever, very low cost, have that internationally observed, and see what comes out of it. Now, if we do that, the downside, if I'm wrong, and if people in that country can't come up with a sensible way of putting the economics, the cultural side, and the environmental side together in, say, an agricultural policy or a national parks policy, for it to take easy ones to start with, and if they couldn't come to agreement, we would have wasted a year. We'd have wasted maybe $500,000. So what? Now, if they do, and the chances are 95%, they come up with a practical, sensible way to solve it, clear policy, which every human is wanting. If they do that, the upside of that, you can't put a price to, because we will have people like yourself solving that middle part of the problem with the citizens, with the institutions. We've got to get creativity going. Let me try and explain that. There's 50 years ago, there were very few people around the world saying we need to mimic nature in what we're doing. Now that's very common, they said. Now, we're managing three things, as we said earlier, and this is indisputable, I believe. right? With nature, I think everybody understands you need complexity. That's why we're so concerned about the loss of biodiversity, because you need diversity. So we can take diversity as good. In economies, as you would understand better than anybody, no economist today argues for a mono economy. We all acknowledge that the more diverse an economy is, the more likely it is to be robust and stable. So of the two things we managed so far, diversity is good. Now we get to human opinion, and diversity becomes divisive and leads us to war. Why? The answer to that is in what we've been talking about, wicked problems. So once we get together and develop policy in one test case on the side, in one nation, if we can get ordinary citizens to support that idea, and we do that, you will find we will need far more diversity of human opinion, but we do it without conflict. That's the secret to it. We're needing more diversity. We've got to pull together. No person has solutions. There isn't the solution. There's a way to solve it.
Yeah.
That's all I'm talking about. Not a silver bullet. I don't have the answer. I have a way for us to solve it.
All right. So Nathan is asking, what do you think of the economics of dropping mass grain and cash crop farming for grazing animals? Does this make sense economically for farmers? Because he hears the argument that this is not workable compared to selling cash crops. What do you think of that? Do you have studies on this?
I missed the first part of that. Just what did I think of?
The economics of switching from cash crop, growing cash crops, to grazing animals.
Well, that would fail.
Why?
It's reductionist. It's simple. You're not dealing with the social, the cultural, the economic consequences, the financing of the farmer. You're not dealing with the complexity of nature. That's one of these many simple ways, people say, of changing production. All that person is suggesting is a way of changing the form of production. That's not where the problem lies. So that will fail.
I'm not so sure we're on the same page on this question. So he's saying, if you have a large farm that you're using for producing cash crops,
yeah,
say grain or corn or soy or whatever, and you're considering moving toward a holistic grazing and holistic management model, what do you think about the economics of it financially? Is it going to work for a farmer? And what is the incentive there? I mean, I presume the incentive is the way that it can be made to work is that you need to utilize the meat and the wool from the animals.
Okay. All right. I think I've got that now. Okay. So ignore what I said just now. Let me try and smooth that over. If I was the farmer with a very large farm and monoculture of corn, soy, whatever, and I was switching, I would switch by managing holistically, which means at no point would I take a decision that is going to go against what my family needs, more prosperity, stable, etc. So I would make the decision holistically, and there are farmers doing that. And I would begin to switch to cover crops and gradual change, whatever, until I had a combination probably of cover crops and livestock. But I'd be doing the best I could because I'm still operating in the United States in an economy driven by politicians that is driving environmental destruction. So I can't be an island to myself. No one farmer can survive. We're all in this boat together. So that's why I'm saying you could, as I said earlier, you can only do the best you can on an individual farm. Now, there we touched on managing holistically. What does it mean? What it means is this. First, let me tell you how we manage at the moment. We never realize that all management is similar. It's the same way as policy development is. So you or I or anybody is every day managing to achieve objectives of some sort or another, and those will be to meet a need, a desire, or to solve a problem. It's very difficult to think of a conscious decision any human makes that is not to meet a need, a desire, or solve a problem. That is reductionist. The problem is beginning right there. Now we will use some tool. And we said earlier, we only have three tools. And there's no tool there that can reverse desertification, biodiversity loss. So this farmer is wise to include cattle in it. Now, how will we make the decision? We will always do it the same way. We'll make it on one or more of many factors: past experience, research results, cultural norms, friends' advice, cost effectiveness, cash flow, etc., etc. Many factors, and we'll make the decision, and that is what is leading to the problem. All right, so now, taking this farmer, how would we do it a little differently? The first thing is, we would have the same reason for our decisions. So we're going to make decisions, and the reason is going to be to meet a need, a desire, or solve a problem. But we're not going to have that as a context for the decision. And so we're going to introduce a new concept. That was the hardest thing to develop, because we didn't know what we were looking for. So we have a new concept, not in any branch of science, in no religion in the world, and in no philosophy, a holistic context. So we would sit with that farmer, and he and his family, or whatever, and the people who are making management decisions or have veto power over those decisions would decide how they want their lives to be, based upon their culture, their values. How do they want their lives to be? Because at the end of the day, it's about how we want our lives to be. Then they would describe that farm, not as it is today, but as it has to be in terms of four processes: how water is cycling, how nutrients are cycling, how biological communities are functioning, and how solar energy is flowing to money and food and everything else through that. They would describe that in the conditions that it'd have to be 200, 300 years from now for our descendants to be living like that. Now, we've got two components of the holistic context. And the final bit would be that farmer has to trade with people, sell, buy, deal with people, deal with government agencies, extension, clients, whatever. You can't change other people. So how will that farmer and his family have to behave? Because at the end of the day, we're judged by our behavior, not our brands, not our slogans, not our mission statements, but all this marketing stuff. You're judged by your behavior. So they would describe how they would have to behave to have loyal clients, decent clients, people supporting them, friend community around with lives like they want. Now they've got a holistic context. There's no prejudice in that. It's 100% how they want their lives to be and the life-supporting environment. It can be developed in an hour or two, a day or two, and then constantly refined. And that becomes the context for our actions. And then we open our minds to using livestock and the holistic planned grazing process anywhere in the world. Just those two new things. That's it. And that farmer now will begin to have completely different results while they meet their needs, their desires, and solve problems.
Excellent. Well, that's wonderful to hear. This is a bit of a long answer, but I think in terms of, I guess the shorter question that Nathan was trying to get at is, what is the economic feasibility? If you wanted to do this as a farmer on your own, have you seen positive economic results for individuals who want to take individual initiative rather than waiting for, you know, something that involves policymakers and politicians and wide-scale societal movements?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You talk about positive results. Don't take my opinion. Deb Steiner, Dr. Steiner, and co-workers published a paper from Ohio State University in the 1980s what she and her co-workers did was they studied early adopters, American farmers who came to me for training in how to manage holistically. And they studied them right across the United States from California to Florida. They took a sample of farmers, and that's published. It's in my textbook. What they found was those early adopters doing what I've just said, all right, averaged 300% more profit. Averaged. Now, over that same time period, and you can go and check this out, roughly 600,000 American farmers went bankrupt, and suicide was the leading cause of death in agriculture. Now, for this cross-section of farmers in that same market to average 300%, I'd say more profit is pretty impressive. Yes, we've seen these sort of results. They've been published. But that doesn't change institutions.
Yes, that's the issue. And I think this is the key thing is that, in my opinion, the thing hampering this idea is an issue of time preference, in that probably monocropping cash crops is probably more beneficial in the short term because you're depleting the soil and you're selling a lot of crops that you can make a lot of quick money on today at the expense of the future health of the soil. Whereas holistic grazing likely reduces your short-term returns as opposed to intensive cash cropping, and therefore it allows you to maximize your revenue in the long run. So in a world in which everybody discounts the long-term very heavily and focuses on the short-term, in that kind of world, you would expect that you would see people shift more and more toward the high time preference kind of agriculture that produces more and more cash crops. Would you agree with that?
I wouldn't agree, no. For the simple reason that when you shift to what you called holistic grazing or holistic management, that the results are not long-term, they're short-term and long-term. Every decision you make when you do it holistically, you go through a filtering process. And as we make the decisions, we're making them in a holistic context that are good for the family, both short and long term. So no family goes into financial hardship to start. We don't do that. You go straight into beginning to be productive. So all the results I told you about, the advanced project where we produced five times as meat, much meat, $1.80 an acre capital outlay, the result was the first year. The people that I just mentioned at Ohio State University, the result was immediate. The result is very rapid. Now, there's a reason for that. Let me explain it. Long ago, I employed economists in my business, my consulting business. And one of them, both of them I met in adverse conditions. One was opposing me in a court case in Namibia, and one was opposing me in the visual trials, but both left their jobs and joined me afterwards. Now, the one in Namibia, I had a coffee break with him during the court trial because he was already changing his thinking. And he said to me, "Alan, price governs cost of production." And I didn't understand that, and I discussed it a bit with him, but it stuck in my mind, and I kept working on it, and absolutely does. So now when we are doing holistic financial planning, the financial part of the planning, right, it's a vital part of it is very critical. In normal budgeting, normal financial planning, as you know better than anyone, basically people plan the income. They plan the various expenses in the budget or the plan, and the difference between is theoretically profit. Now, when we're doing holistic financial planning, we don't do it that way. We plan the initial income, and then we acknowledge the human mind, and that the human mind, the cost of production rises automatically to close to the anticipated income. So we take that psychological aspect into mind. Remember, we're managing human, economy, and nature together. And what we do is we've planned the income. we now slash the income drastically, 50% if need be. And we slash it and we plan the profit before we plan all the other expenses. So here's our income, here's our planned profit. Now we've got this amount of money left, let's let the expenses rise to that. And lo and behold, as I said in that Ohio State University study, the farmers doing that with me averaged 300% more profit.
That's incredible. Nathan is also asking, are you familiar with the work of Gabe Brown, Greg Judy, and Joel Salatin?
Absolutely. I don't know Greg Judy as well. Gabe Brown, I know. He refers to me in his book and using a lot of ideas that come from me and a lot of his own. And he's doing what we talked about earlier, cover crops and integrating livestock and chickens and things with it, and doing very, very well. And you can read his book. And Joel Salatin, I know Joel well, and he again is doing very well. He's a superb marketer. He markets very differently from other people. But neither of them is doing exactly what I'm talking about, but that doesn't matter. They are some of the creative farmers in America that are leading the way. You'll find, if you look at what's happening worldwide in Australia and Southern Africa and Europe and so on, the lead in agriculture is coming from farmers and ranchers, and they're literally dragging government agencies and universities kicking and screaming behind them. The creativity is coming from ordinary people. Don't forget that all the creativity that made civilization possible, that domesticated every crop we have, every animal we have, every bird we have, was made possible by ordinary farmers discussing around the kitchen table, the campfire, taking one weed off the coast of Britain and making, I think, six vegetables we have today. There wasn't a single university. There wasn't a single academic. That's ordinary farmers. They're some of the most creative people in the world. And these farmers you mentioned are very creative fellows. They're doing wonderful work. It's our institutions that are the problem. I keep saying that.
Yes. Yeah, no, absolutely. All right. Well, I really want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. This has been incredibly informative and fascinating. I really appreciate your time, and I really wish you all the best. And but if you could just please let us know where people can find you online and what you're up to these days.
Well, the Savory Institute's got a website. I forget. I don't look at it myself, but it's easy to find. And there's that. There's a textbook out in its third edition, Holistic Management. I can send you some links if you haven't already got them to the COP26 talk, which is very relevant, and to the TED talk, which is very relevant to what we've been saying. I think those two would help people. And then if anybody listening can in any way find any scientist or themselves, tell me where what I'm saying is wrong logically or where the science is wrong, please tell me and I'll help spread it around the world. I have no monopoly on being right. I'm not trying to be right. I've just spent 60-odd years trying to find a way to solve these problems, working with thousands of other people on, what, 5 continents?
Yes. Excellent. And the website is savory.global, and we're going to be posting a whole bunch of links in the show notes. So check it out. It's on safedean.com/podcast, or wherever you get your podcast, you'll get the podcast description. You'll see a whole bunch of links to Alan Savory's talks and his website and studies that we mentioned during this study. Thank you again so much for taking the time.
Thank you, and I hope we can keep working together. Thank you.
Cheers. Take care. Bye-bye. Yeah.